A lot of people in this great big world say love everybody. A lot of people busy being very modern.
The family and noise is here and it's come to save everybody. Family and noise is here and it's come to save you and me.
It goes.
Family and noise is here and it's come to save everybody. Family and noise is here and it's come to save you and me.
You have to, yeah, so it's fine.
You got John Phil Ryan's kids over there?
We had a guest named John Phil Ryan who had the loudest kids. I don't know if they're the loudest kids. I think all kids are probably loud, but he has the kids. So you are in a coffee shop in where now? Peru or?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, hi. First, hi, and who is the other fellow on the line?
Oh, this is
Hey, Alex, my name is Bill.
Hi, Bill.
How the hell are you?
I'm sitting in my hotel. I'm good. I'm in my hotel room in Puno, Peru right now because it's got a pretty solid connection. And I wanted to be up on the roof. That's where the screaming kids are. So I decided it's just better for purposes of the show to be in as quiet a place as I could be.
Great. You might want to turn down your volume ever so. I don't know if, Bill, you're having the same experience, but it's a little loud.
I can just move away. How's that? Is that better?
Probably works, too. I think today I'd received a letter from Alex in response to our Jan Irving show that was very insightful. And Alex has a lot of familiarity around Mayan culture, and Jan Irving aside, I felt like he had a lot to say in that area that I felt would be applicable and helpful, especially after the predicted time that everyone was so anxiously awaiting for and apparently is disillusioned about now. So I thought maybe you could kind of offer some ideas there.
I'd be happy to. I mean, I have to say that I have no professional credentials in this area. I'm just a traveler who has spent a lot of time with Native American culture from Ontario all the way to Argentina. And many of these cultures, perhaps not all, but the vast majority of them have in common some archetypal worldviews that are at odds with the way the Mayan Uxlabactún, which is the Mayan name for the 2012 event, is perceived. What I believe happened is that northern culture, European North American Christian culture, imposed its or parts of its worldview on the Mayan Uxlabactún in a way that created a kind of apprehension that was misplaced. In European and North American culture, we have a linear sense of time. We have a sense of progress. We have also in our religious background, there's this sense of you go through life, and then at the end, you achieve your reward or punishment. But in Mayan worldview, as well as Aymara, which is the Andean South American, as well as many others, but those being the two biggest and most important. And the Aymara culture is often mistaken as the Inca culture, and I'll just add briefly right there that the Incas came just a very short while before the Spanish. So whatever we think of as Inca culture is really Aymara culture, which is like the Greeks and the Romans. The Incas are the Romans who conquered the Greeks and took their culture. So the Incas took the Aymara culture and made it their own. In a similar way, the Aztecs took the Mayan culture and made it their own. And you see many of the same things with the Aztecs as are in the Mayans. They just changed the name. Quetzalcoatl is the Aztec name. Kulkulan is the Mayan name for the plumed serpent, the sort of sky god, the male head deity. We have similar things in South America, similar things also going north up into Canada, although it gets a little different because those cultures were much more widespread and less populated and less advanced and so on. But to get back to what I was saying about the linear concept of time that is European, if you take that and you map it onto the Mayan worldview, you come up with this notion of an end point. And if you add to that a Protestant, I'll call it Protestant, although there are elements of it in Catholicism as well, but a Protestant notion of apocalypse, then you get this idea of the end of the world. And that simply is not correct. That is not what the Ushlabaktun is. Ushlabaktun means the return of light, not the end of the world, the return of light. It is a beginning point, not an end point. And in Mayan worldview, there is a period of what might you call it? You might call it divine retribution, or you might call it consequence or punishment, that we must pay for our mistakes and our imperfections and our immorality and things like that. But that comes at the Ushlabaktun. It comes during the 500 years before the Ushlabaktun, which incidentally actually corresponds to the conquistadors. So according to the Mayan timetables, the conquistadors arrived at just the right time. You had 500 years of, hellish violence and cultural dismantling, some of which continues to this day. Then you have the Ushlabaktun, which is the return of the light, and that can be interpreted in many different ways. A lot of New Agers interpreted it as a grand awakening of humanity, and one would hope that that would happen, but there are other interpretations to this new beginning. In a sense, anyone can put their own interpretation on it. One of the things that I find very interesting, I spent half a year in Guatemala, and I learned a lot about what they call the Dirty War, mid-1960s to the mid-1990s, where all kinds of things took place, including genocide. And I thought that maybe a new beginning might be to bring to justice some of the war criminals. And in fact, prior president of Guatemala is now up on war crimes charges and is being tried for it. And corollary to that might be the removal of laws against, I should say it a different way, the removal of heresy laws that still exist in Guatemala, where the indigenous population, which is 65% of the population of that country, practice some sort of religion and are doing so legally. They practice syncretism, they put a Catholic face on it. But technically, they're not allowed to do that stuff. So the Ushlabaktun could be something as simple as bringing some war criminals to justice and allowing the natives to have their culture flourish again. Or it could be something as big as the sort of new age view of a human awakening worldwide. But the point is, it's really open to interpretation. And there is no specific delineation of what this new beginning means. It's more tied in with the cycles of time, and that is where I think the greatest difference culturally exists, and what I find fascinating, and which is also universal. You find a universal among the Native Americans. You find it far north, you find it far south. Where I am now in the Aymara culture, it is a big thing as well, which is the cyclical nature of time. And what that does to the way people look at life and how they live life, they're much less concerned with achieving greatness, because there is no ultimate reward for that. That's more of a burden, which is why the elders are respected and the people that hold responsibility are very respected, because they do that out of a moral obligation, not out of self-aggrandizement.
Right. So you say open to interpretation, and yet what's interesting is you're saying that there was a kind of a Christian consensus reality that was kind of projected onto the Mayan culture that we see affecting our view of it today, but even at the time with the conquistadors, that's just what they did. And so I find it interesting that even to say something is open to interpretation over time has itself been considered a heresy to even suggest such a thing in approaching the various texts. And so I had a interesting study session the other day looking at a 16th century explanation that hadn't been published until, you know, the last, I don't know, 50 years or something, of commentary on the Zohar expressing that the Torah was meant to be looked at as written on the body of the serpent in the garden and was ultimately to be shed in time, and that the law itself was a temporary thing. And this is emphasized by the idea that when Moses stepped down off the mountain, he came down twice, right? And the first set of commandments that he had were not laws as such. It was when he saw what was going on that he, you know, it was recognized that people weren't ready to shed that. And so, you know, not to go into a whole thing around that, but I just feel like the serpent is like a central point in not just Mayan culture, but almost universally. And the symbolism of the serpent, and you look at the idea of the spiral and the cyclical nature of reality and specifically time. Do you have any words on the meaning of the serpent in Mayan culture or even your interpretation of that?
Well, one of the things I was going to say regarding the whole open to interpretation part of this is it's very difficult for a European or a North American or Asian, for that matter, anyone outside of the Mayan culture to really get deep understanding and accurate instruction and education in their religion and worldview, because that stuff is off limits. The Mayan shamanic order is extremely hierarchical and very secretive, which is something else I want to add. There's a kind of romanticism that is imposed, that we impose an apocalyptic view on them that I believe comes from a Christian and Protestant mindset. But we also tend to put a kind of romanticism on the Mayans and the Incas and other natives that is, in many respects, misplaced. Because I talked and tried to study as much as I could with about 23 different Mayan shaman. One of them was a Madrona, so I guess really she wasn't a shaman, she was a Madrona. But it's almost impossible. And I have to say, it's even more difficult with the Aymara culture to really get accurate information, because they are not supposed to be giving us that. And in fact, they're not supposed to be giving it within their own culture. You have to earn your way in the shamanic order to various levels of responsibility and levels of knowledge. So whatever I was told really would be at the very most elementary first level, and it would only be partial. It would, you know, so I'm only getting a piece of the picture. So to comment on the significance of the serpent beyond saying that it is representative of evolution. If you think about it, the snake is the most evolved of reptiles. So it's representative of evolution, which is this concept in cultural sense of development. As you gain more wisdom in the metaphysic of Mayan worldview and are then elevated to the next level of shaman, you're kind of on the next part of the spiral. You're on the next step up of the spiral, if you will. You might have a completely, not completely new, but a broadened view of its significance. So I'm sorry to say that with any degree of accuracy, I can only tell you that I do agree that it is representative of time, but it is also representative of a concept of evolution that could be taken to be scientific or biological in the sense of the serpent being a high evolved reptile, but also in the sense of personal and spiritual development. Another reason I believe, and this is a personal view that was nodded to when I presented it to a shaman, is that it's also important that the serpent is not human. This is a different intelligence. It's a different creature altogether, which is a reminder that there are other beings and intelligences out there. It's also representative as an archetype. Okay, so the serpent, you can take it at a literal level. You can take it in a figurative way, but you also see it often in other respects. So one of the only words that has come to us in English from the Mayans is hurricane, the sky, one of the sky gods. And of course a hurricane has a spiral or pinwheel type shape.
Totally.
So again, see the snake represented, but it's not in the case of Kukulkan, which is the feathered serpent. That's a very specific kind of deity. But you see the snake again and again represented archetypally when the Mayans, in this case, have a kind of animism where they imbue everything with spirit in various ways, where you see spirals.
Wow, there's an interesting synchronicity there, just with the hurricane has its singular eye, right? And so you have a link then that's made between the serpent and the single eye. I don't know. It's interesting.
Anyway, I don't know if that helps you, but
that's very helpful.
I reacted to that show you had because there were a couple of things that I find in Terica, and I'm a hobbyist, okay? I don't have a PhD in this or anything. I have been reading and experiencing and not just changing my life dramatically over the years as a result of things that I've learned both in reading but then also in life and in my many travels. And one of the personal arguments I have against many of the people who study esoterica is they are looking for ownership. they're basically looking for, they look at the world and they look at society and they realize that they're not being told the truth. And then they go out looking for the truth. They find some things that are very interesting, and then they, maybe they see correlations in the world, and then they jump to conclusions. And there's an attempt to own things. So what I see a lot is people who study esoterica getting very angry at the government or what have you, and then coming up with a an alternative view that, in my mind, is really no better than what it is they're trying to overcome.
Sure.
And there's so much anger in there. The anger, I think, also comes from a sense of being left out and of being misled and deceived. And perhaps many of us have been left out and we have been deceived. And so there might be some reason to feel that. But what I see a lot of is a kind of attempt to take back the control that they believe they have lost by studying esoterica and drawing conclusions from it. Now, some of the things the fellow said were true, but I also think some of the things he said were not true. So this, to me, is one of the key elements of the study of any mystical pursuit, which is to remember that nothing is ever completely clear. That's part of the point of it. That ties in with what I was saying about the levels of development of the Mayan shamans. You never get the full picture. So one must be very careful about what one says is the truth, because your understanding of whatever that is highly limited. And we must remember all the time that we are also fallible. So, for example, the other day I was up at 15,000 feet in the Andes, and I had no idea how dumb I was. I'm sorry, I don't care how good you are, how in shape you are, whatever. You go up to altitude, you're dumb for a while. You know, you have to acclimatize. So in the same way, whatever situation we are in requires an adaptation of our abilities to put ourselves in the proper perspective in terms of what we know and also what we don't know. The Mayans and the Aztecs have this wonderful concept. The Aztec word is Nahual, which is the, I like to describe it in terms of mathematical theory, is the set of all things in the universe we don't know. So this is very central to the Mayan and the Aztec worldview, more so than some of the other Native Americans that have things in common, like naturalism and cyclical time and all that, which is, I think, quite interesting because it's universal to Native Americans or quasi-universal. But more particular to the Mayans and the Aztecs is this notion that one must put one's knowledge and one's wisdom in the perspective of the Nahual, the vast universe of things, of knowledge we do not possess. If we look at it from the point of view of science in the West, think about it. I mean, Newton came along and he was this great genius and he figured all this stuff out and everything was great until Einstein came along and that blew that whole thing out of the water. Then Bohr came along and kind of blew Einstein out of the water. You know, and lately I've been interested in recent advances in mathematics that are calling into question a lot of these other things. So, you know, science is kind of our religion at this point. And it has its advantages of empirical methodology and reproducible empirical fact. Nevertheless, it too will be supplanted someday. And that's part of the beauty of science.
Sure.
Is that you need to have people that are willing to question it, the dogma of it.
Right, so we're kind of restating our assumptions when we introduce our theories, right, which remain theories even if they're relatively proven, right? Because things have to be kept in perspective, I guess, is what you're saying. That we haven't come across an ultimate truth in any of this. And so, you know, but at the same time, that doesn't mean it has no value. It just means its value has to be kept in perspective.
And this is an important point, getting what we were saying before about interpretation. So Newton and Newton's laws are true in the world we live in. If you drop an apple, it's going to fall every single time. Okay, so it's not that it has been completely supplanted and it's not true. It is true within the situation in which it is true. So the truths that exist are not necessarily completely negated by advances. They are put in their proper perspective. Now, how does this get back into interpretation? It gets back into interpretation because there is not just, it's not cultural or metaphysical relativism, okay? That is a problem because, well, it's not a problem, it's just a mistake because anyone can say anything based on how they feel at the moment, okay? And it may or may not be true, and it doesn't really matter. It's just opinion, really, as opposed to perspective. So there's a nuance between one's interpretation within a context and within a given set of truths or knowledge is a kind of relativism that is simply an excuse to promote whatever you believe at the time to be a universal truth. So I don't know if that makes sense, but there is an important distinction there.
Sure. I think here we kind of set the intention that if we're going to explore different ideas, we do our best at, like I said, keep things in perspective. But at the same time, there's kind of a joy that comes out of like letting go of the restrictions in order to actually explore territory. Like some of the more profound realizations I've had have actually come through play. And then I'll have to stop and be like, wait a minute, there actually was something to that. And kind of backtrack and go through my steps and realize, wow, there's something there. Even though I was just exploring different ideas kind of loosely, I actually came upon something. And so, you know, a lot of the older esoteric texts that I look at, it's emphasized that that's simply what they're doing. They're just exploring different, they don't present it as an authority. There are a lot, many, many esoteric texts that do present every little thing that they present in an authoritative way. But then there's others that's just more like commentaries where they're just, well, let's look at it from this angle. Well, let's look at it from this angle. And so it's like what you were saying with the serpent. It's like you got one interpretation that was given to you, yet there's probably others. It's like the G doesn't necessarily stand for geometry, although it could, you know.
Right. Or it does in X situation.
Yeah.
Right? When we're in this place at this time, that's what it means.
Right. You know, if we're going to think about building...
It can mean many other things.
If we're going to think about building an architecture, which I think is a major component to Mayan civilization, or at least to how I understand them, one thing that I remembered from reading José Arguelles' book, The Mayan Factor... a fact that he addresses, which I don't really have any reference point to whether it was true or not, but he cites that the Mayans constructed their temples without the use of the wheel, or that they did not employ the wheel in their engineering. And it just seems like such a profoundly absurd element to such a grand and beautiful civilization. I'm just wondering if you know if there's any truth to that statement, and if that is true, what does that say about a society that was so enveloped in circular time or cyclical time, and yet they forego the use of the wheel in constructing massive buildings? Because that just seems like you've got your linear time and your linear civilizations doing everything because of the wheel. Can you speak to that at all?
I can. It's interesting. And also, they didn't really have domestication of animals either, whereas the Aymara and Inca did. So, you know, there's some interesting gaps in the Mayans like that. The thing about the architecture, okay, about the wheel, I don't know what more to add other than, you know, that is, to my knowledge, correct. Oh, and one other thing that's interesting about Jose Velez is that I believe he was either severely reprimanded or punished or perhaps even excommunicated because he not only brought out to the world things that were supposed to be it, but he put his own spin on it. And so among the shaman community, particularly among the Yucatec shaman community, and that's a whole other topic because the Mayans are really divided into two major groups, the Yucatec and the Quiche. But among Yucatec, I believe he was basically kicked out. So he still has shaman status, and I don't know how high up of a shaman he was, but he was kicked out, as far as I know. So I think his work is interesting, but he was it's been a long time since I read that book. But he was kind of the proponent of the first proponent of this concept of a human awakening, which is a very optimistic, hopeful, positive thing. I'm not saying that, you know, one should not strive for that. I'm simply saying I'm not sure that that was anything but his interpretation, his spin on the knowledge. Now, as far as architecture goes, what's most fascinating to me is yes, okay, the structures and the architecture are amazing, and when you first encounter it, these kinds of questions are forefront. Like, they did this without the wheel? That's amazing. But what's more amazing to me is the intricacy of the architecture as it is tied into their metaphysic. So they were amazing astronomers and mathematicians, and that is imbued in everything in their society. And also they had concepts of how the powers of the heavens, namely the relations of the stars and astronomy, also have a manifestation or a reflection on the earth. Mayans, in particular, were big believers in the localization of energies on land or inland, or commonly known as energy waypoints and ley lines. And they constructed their society that way. I mean, the architecture, the physical society, where they put towns, how they constructed towns, how big the towns were, how many pyramids they had, all this kind of stuff, was all tied into a reflection of the heavens, not in the sense, in the Christian sense, in the sense of the vast universe and all the stars, reflected in the Mother Earth. And by the way, that is something that is also shared by the Andean South American societies and cultures. So from my point of view, the more I got into the Mayan world, both in Chiapas and Yucatan and also in Guatemala, and that's something that's universal among all the Mayans, and there, by the way, are 24 separate cultural subgroups of Mayans, all of which exist to this day, and they all have different languages and so on. But all of that, all of those hold this in common, that what it, you know, this is this concept that gets back to, you know, if it's true above, it's true below, right? The Star of David and all of that Western esoteric knowledge that says that whatever is true here and is true there. So this is something I find very fascinating because of that connection where there are so many areas where Native American cultures, whether it's Mayan or whether it's Ojibwe up in Ontario or whether it's far south Argentina, are completely different from the Western worldview. This is one area where they intersect. So that makes it almost universal.
Wow, okay. Do you see a like a connection between like when we talk about the Mayan calendar, it's kind of suggested that we're talking about a prophecy. Yet when there's no specifics that are given to the prophecy, like the Apocrypha or anything like that, it seems to be expressing an inner reality. And so when you're looking at the heavens and you're applying them to the earth, you're making a connection that's a type of inference in a way that has more to do with dynamics than literally this is the same as this. Like, we're not literally saying that the planets in the sky are here on Earth, yet the dynamics that they express and their energetic relationships are expressed on this plane. And so could you be saying the same thing in terms, that's in the case of space, could you be saying the same thing in terms of time? Like, could you apply the idea that you see the dynamics that are occurring here, and you can recognize that if this continues, what will that mean for our future? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. And first off, I want to for clarifying that, because listeners might get an idea. Most of the things I'm talking about are, in some sense, abstract. The literal interpretations are fraught with difficulties. Just look at all the literal interpretations throughout history of Christianity, okay, and what we see people doing when they interpret things literally. So I generally try to stay away from that. So thank you for bringing that up. What I'm talking about is in terms of the ley lines and energy points on the Earth is not, you're correct, a direct correlation to this planet or that star. It's more like what you said. So yes, that's true. Now, in terms of time, one thing I think that's important to clarify for everyone is that there is not a Mayan calendar. There are, I believe, 19 of them. And they all they're all coexistent. Okay, so there is not a calendar that invalidates another. They all work together, and it's profoundly complex. I spent a little bit of time studying the Mayan calendar, and wow, I mean, it's just immense. If you want to, they had shaman that for example, in Tikal back in the day, you would go to the plaza and you would make your offering, and you would pay the shaman some money to paint a picture for you. And when we talk about pictures in Mayan, in the Mayan world, we're also talking about writing. Because one of the things that I find the most fascinating about them is, of all the cultures I've ever seen, way more than the Egyptians or the Chinese, the Mayans really melded together creative visual art and written language. So you would go pay your shaman and ask him for wisdom for the day. And the reason you couldn't come up with wisdom for the day yourself is because you have 19 levels of intersection of significance that have to be understood in order to create an interpretation about what this day might mean for you. Unfortunately, the conquistadors succeeded in destroying more than 500,000 books, and I believe only five remain. The intricacies of the kind of day-to-day ways that they use the calendars are lost, but those calendars are there. Now, the one that you're talking about is called the long count calendar. And the reason the long count calendar is associated with prophecy is because we see the events unfolding in time on the large scale, on the, like I was talking about before, with the conquistadors showing up at 500 years prior to the Ushla Bakhtun, right in sync with what the long calendar would say. So you have to see it in the terms of the big view, which is very hard to do when you're stuck here in this moment. So in other words, it's very hard for us to determine what is the significance of the Ushla Bakhtun until, 500 or 1,000 years have passed. And then we can look back and say, oh, okay, that's what that was. And that's why the long count calendar is so interesting in terms of studying history. And we see a kind of accuracy there that's phenomenal. And lots of esoteric thinkers have talked about this. I believe it was Terence McKenna that was doing something with that and mathematics or something like that. I may be wrong about that. But this is a fascinating area for esoteric research. From my point of view, what it says is not so much that it is prophecy, okay? Let me put it this way. Prophecy may be a word that we have a Western cultural association with. Prophets, when you think about Isaiah or Daniel or Ezekiel or whoever they may be, talking about things that are going to happen in the future. In fact, right now we have a moment where the prophecies of Saint Malachi are forefront because of the Pope's resignation. But anyway, that's a whole other topic. The point is, though, that our Western notion of prophecy is about interpreting the future, whereas I think the Mayan point of view is about understanding how the cycles work. So in other words, there are always going to be new cycles, okay? And the new Ushla Bakhtun is the beginning of a new 5,126-year period. And a lot of people forget that there are also longer periods in Mayan time. I believe the longest one is something like 144,000 years. But we come to this and we want to interpret it, but it's not so much about what's going to happen in the future as in understanding these different segments of time, from the very smallest, which is one day in the Mayan worldview, to these very, very large expanses of time. How does the cycle work? If we can understand how the cycle works, then maybe we will be able to understand what's happening now. Does that make sense to you?
Sure. Yeah, I would say that even that there's a, like I had mentioned earlier, there's a problem when we have our Western interpretation of these things. Like you mentioned the six-pointed star. I mean, I saw that symbol all over India. There's nothing Western about it other than the fact that we've adopted it and then we make our particular association. And our understanding of prophecy turns into this notion of like fortune telling on a grand scale that applies to everybody or something, like to be able to peer into the future through like a crystal ball. Whereas even in the Tanakh, you have like Ezekiel, there's nothing future telling about it. What you're looking at is a like peering
I
to the
lost you.
Well, I'm just emphasizing that there's like a peering of the wiring under the board rather than like a direct like snapshot of what's going to be taking place 1,000 years from now. It's not, I mean, you can see that that's kind of suggested with Revelations, but then even there, it's not. Do you mean you lost me, like you can't hear me, or you didn't get what I was expressing? Hello?
We might have lost him.
Oh, we may have lost him. Oh, that's what he's saying.